As we gather here this Sunday, we are smack dab in the middle of a graduation season. And so we will be finding well-known people, presidents, ex-presidents, first ladies, titans in business, folks who are stars in the acting or entertainment industry, standing before graduates and sharing their life-accumulated wisdom, offering inspiration, advice, things to help those graduates take that next step into their lives. It was over 30 years ago that I heard Carol Burnett speak at the UCLA graduation that I attended, and I can't really tell you now a thing that Carol said that day, but I'm sure it was great, inspired, and knowing her is probably funny as well. Perhaps you can recall what was said at your graduation. My guess is that probably most of us can't. Often those words have a way of kind of not sticking very deeply. But this morning, we are going to take a look at what I consider to be the greatest commencement speech ever offered. It was spoken not by a president, by a CEO, by an entertainment star. It was spoken by a rabbi. And his class of students was rather small. He only had 12. 3 years prior to this commencement speech, he spent some time calling some folks to be his students, to be in the vernacular of his day, to be his disciples. And unlike Harvard or Yale, Jesus was not choosing the best and the brightest at that time. He had his own internal calculation. He called folks who were fishermen, tax collectors, folks who really were pretty nondescript folks to come and spend some time with him. And once he collected them, he didn't put them in a classroom and lecture to them. He said, come with me. Follow me. And so they spent 3 years inseparable. They traveled with him. They watched him give sermons to people. They heard him tell these stories called parables that depicted God in surprising ways. They watched him go into funerals and raise the dead. They watched him invite prostitutes and other sinners to be part of the family of God. And after 3 years, he gathers these 12 students into a room to give them some advice, some hope, some wisdom, because it's time for them to graduate. The graduation is not something that was declared by a timing of completing academic work, but because that very night he was going to be arrested. And they would need to move from being disciples and students to something bigger, something greater. The Gospel of John records for us these inspired words of Jesus shared on the last night of his life. These words, even 20 centuries later, have the power to transform those who hear them and obey them. So I invite you to do just that now as I share these words from the Gospel of John. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, and so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. This is my command: love each other. Well, graduation is not just an occasion for someone to give a speech and for people to switch a tassel from one side of the hat to the other. A graduation actually is a very important marker. It's one of those time stamps that commemorates the end of one chapter in life and focuses on the chapter that's arriving. Graduation serves as that segue between being a high school student and perhaps going off to college or finding a job. Graduation marks that time when we might get a degree from college and go out and become an employee or an entrepreneur or a parent. That graduation is a way, a very important way of signifying that something significant is afoot. Change is happening. We go from being a student, for example, to finding our way in the real world. Well, in this portion of Jesus' commencement speech to his own disciples, he also shares with them that they are about to take a very important step, that their identity is about to change, that they had one job, a task that they were doing up until now, but from now on, it's going to be something very different. This meal marks that hinge point in the life of the disciples. Jesus shares, tells them, I no longer call you servants. Because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. Up until now, Christ says, you were my students. You were servants. You were disciples. Your job was to follow me, to learn from me. Your job was to do what I asked you to do. Your job was to grant me authority in your life that you might be in a place of receiving what I offer. But now you no longer are servants. Now I want to call you my friends. And he points out there's a world of difference between those that we count as friends and those that might be part of our lives but don't have the access to our hearts. As we all know, friendship is not a matter of proximity in our lives. Just because we happen to share a classroom with other students or a workplace with other employees, just because we might live in the same geographical area, or even might be products of the same family tree, that does not necessarily mean that we are friends. Friendship's not a matter primarily of biology or geography. It's a matter of the heart. It's a matter of deciding that there's something that we share that allows our hearts to be connected. That friendship says there's a place of transparency and commitment. That there's a place of connection that arises from one's own choice of one's heart to share that with. Now, the way I'm describing friendship might be a bit different than the way, for example, that Facebook understands that term. You know, friendship seems so easy when you use social media. You just click on a button. Now we're friends. How easy was that? And I know folks on Facebook who have not just hundreds, but some folks who have several thousand friends. Amazing! But really, in real life, we tend not to have hundreds or thousands of friends. It tends to be a much smaller group. I read this past week of a study that was done by Scientific American. And the study found that we normally speak about 16,000 words every day. Some of us I know speak fewer than that. Others of us I know speak a lot more than that. And you might think, how many people in the course of a day do I share those 16,000 words with? And what they found was whether or not you were an extrovert or an introvert, there was a common pattern around how we share those 16,000 words. The study found, quote, although most of us converse with between 7 and 15 people every day, about 80% of our words are shared with a small group of about 5 trusted confidants, allies, and buddies. That means that close to 13,000 of our 16,000 daily words are directed at a very small group of friends and confidants. These closest co-workers, team members, family members, and friends make up our true inner circle. These are the people who think like us, care about us, and believe in us. Well, Jesus followed that same pattern. Yes, there were times where he spoke words we're told to thousands of people. And there were times that he would move through a village and he would talk to this person here, that person there. But for the most part, most of his words were directed at this group of 12. And then there were times where he'd take even a smaller group, 3 or 4, away, and he would pour even more words into them. That Jesus wanted to be able to share his heart most deeply with those who were part of his inner circle. And what he wanted to share, most of all, was what he had learned from his Father. That what he wanted to share was what he came to understand and to know about God, who he understood to be Abba, Dad. But he had this sense that he knew God in a way that the world did not yet know. And he wanted to share that information through all that he did, through telling stories, through healing, through inviting others to be part of the family of God. So I have this deep, intimate connection to the Father. And I want you all to be a part of that. What he's sharing here is something that we might think of as being like insider information. He has access to something really important, and he wants to share that with those who are willing to listen. Now, in other contexts, for example, in terms of stock market, sharing insider information is a crime. It'll land you in jail, get you fined. I researched this past week and found that the SEC defines insider information this way. It's a non-public fact regarding the plans or condition of a publicly traded company that could provide a financial advantage when used to buy or sell shares of the company's stock. Insider information is typically gained by someone who is working within or close to a listed company. Well, we just kind of change the wording about that a little bit. Jesus has a non-public understanding, not of a company, but of God. And he knew that this information about God could enrich people far beyond ways that the stock market ever could. That what he could share about God would enrich people's souls, it would bless their spirits, it would transform their minds, that it would revolutionize the way they saw themselves and God, other people. It would create a transformation of one's purpose in life. But he had this deeply intimate understanding of God. And over he comes back to the core of what that knowledge entails. And he says this. He says, if you keep my commands, you will remain in my love. He doesn't say, if you keep my commands, you will be right or holy or better than the people. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love. My command is this. There's only one. Love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. This is what the Christian faith boils down to. He doesn't say, my command is this. Go and try to control other people's lives. Go and try to get laws passed that enact what I think. My command is this, love each other. I was telling somebody after the first service, we were talking about that sermon, I said, you know, if I knew I had 1 week left to live, and I had just one sermon to preach, it would be this one. So it all comes down to, this is what identifies us authentically as being Christians. And at the heart of it, there's this understanding that Christ reveals that God, in God's very nature, is not a God who is a harsh judge. God, despite what religion has created, is not a God who has a record book in his hand looking forward to marking off all of our transgressions that he might then lower the hammer on us. God is not someone who gets excited to be able to discipline his people. God is not someone who merely formed us and steps back and has a disinterested view of us. God is a God, no, as who stands on his tiptoes on the front porch waiting for that son or daughter to come back home, to come to their senses. And when they do, he doesn't beat them up. He throws a party for goodness sake. He says, welcome back. And he puts a ring on their finger. and throws a party. God is a God who notices the prostitute, the tax collector, the rejected person, and says, you are part of my family. God throws wide the doors of his kingdom and says, come on in, all who are willing to take my offer. But God is a God who is crazy in love with his people and will stop at nothing to express that. Jesus came. Why? Why did he come? He came because the Bible says God so loved the world that he sent his love, his Son, that love motivated the journey of the Son to us. Why? Because God, who formed us in love, had his heart broken when we rebelled against God, and so God came to us in love to restore us to God. And after Christ fulfilled his ministry, God then, in love, sent his own Spirit to dwell in his people. Why? So God could be joined in love to us and empower the church to go out and do what? To show forth God's love to the world. Love is always the motivating factor for every single thing that God does. There's nothing that God ever does that is outside of the realm of doing it for love. Nothing. Ever. So Christ came with a desire to download that insider information. God is not harsh. God is not condemning. God does not take sides. God always acts in love to redeem his people. Always, always, always. He understood that he was part of this connection with God the Father and the Spirit, where all three persons of that Trinity are always flowing, always moving, never static, always moving and flowing in self-giving love for each other. The Father sends a Son to the world, what? Out of love. The Son obeys the Father. Why? Because the Son loves the Father. The Spirit comes to fulfill Christ's calling. Why? Because the Spirit in love honors the Father and the Son. They always move in this capacity, this dance of pouring out themselves for the other. The Trinity is not this distinct three persons who never interact. It's this constant movement of self-giving love that flows through the heart of everything. This world was birthed out of that communion, which means that every particle, every sense of our DNA, every atom that is formed was formed out of love, in love, and is sustained by love. The Bible says that all of creation is held together by the love of God. That's the reality that exists. And part of our human tragedy is that we live in opposition to what is real. So we are already joined, all of us, in an inseparable way. Why? Because God formed each one of us in love, died for each one of us in love, sustains all of us through love. We are already joined together in a deeper level than anything that could ever divide us. But we humans so often live under a lie, under illusion. We see differences, we judge those differences, we allow fears to arise, and we do things to each other that are horrible. We speak words that are shameful. We enact acts of violence. We continue to engage in warfare. Why? Because we really don't understand that we are killing our very brothers and sisters and breaking the heart of our Father. So the church is called to model this self-giving love that God revealed to us through his Son. And Christ invites us to make that the central purpose of our lives. He tells the disciples these words the night before what? That he's about to lay down his life for his friends. These 12 who shortly will be betraying him, denying him, fleeing from him, abandoning him. He's going to lay his life down for them. And he says to them, once I do that, then you, as my friend, those who get this, those who share my heart, those who share this intimacy with me, you then are going to be sent out to do the same thing. That's your mission. That's it. It's not that complicated. You got one thing to do. And so often the church has decided, well, that's a little difficult, so let's do other things that are less challenging. Let's be more focused on being right or powerful or this or that. No, here it is. Love each other as I have loved you. Just do that, I'd be happy. He says, I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. This is my command, love each other. Now, a disciple of Jesus, a student, somebody still in class might read that and think about that, might even memorize that, might ponder what that really means, might debate it in one's mind. What does love really mean? And how far does the other include? I mean, love each other, does that include people I don't like? Does love mean I have to really care? What a disciple, a student, might get lost in trying to figure out what this means. But a friend of Jesus says, oh, I get it. I'll do it. See, a friend of Jesus cares enough about Christ that they want to do this because they know they shared this overarching, compelling motivation with their Lord. There's a story where one of the animators who worked with the DreamWorks team was given a drawing that someone had made of Jesus. And this person gave it to this famous animator and asked for the opinion. And the animator looked at the drawing for a while and said, well, I guess what I can tell you is if you loved him more, you would have drawn him better. And I think about that. If we loved Jesus more, might we be more concerned with presenting him to the world in a better way? Because we don't want to let down our friends. We don't want to do things that grieve their hearts. So a friend of Jesus says, oh, my central purpose in life is to love others as Christ has loved me. We heard from Nancy earlier that many people in this church do exactly that as they lay down their lives in pockets of time and energy. They show up down the hall in the classrooms with hearts ready to invest in God's children. They take time to prepare lesson plans. The other people show up at meetings and try to figure out and wrestle with how do we make our community more racially just. The other people show up in very nondescript ways behind the scenes who make the coffee, who go out and visit those who are in hospitals, who provide meals for those who need a tangible expression of concern. There are those who notice people when they're hurting. And they do it not just here, but in classrooms and workplaces, neighborhoods, and they express words of authentic compassion. They show up. They offer themselves. Even if offering themselves might make their lives a little more complicated, give them more things to do. They do it because they know that fundamentally life is defined not by how busy you are, by how comfortable you are, by how much money you have, but by how well you loved other people. And I see that example so often manifested as people just step up so often in sacrificial ways to help to build up the body of Christ that we call here Geneva Church. But we also do that in other ways. We do it every time, for example, that we are parents. I still remember that as soon as Julia was born 23 years ago or so, that our lives changed. We said goodbye to a full night's sleep for almost 3 years. We said goodbye to, well, let's just spontaneously go out to a movie. That became a 3-day planning exercise, right? You say goodbye to all those other thoughts you might have had about taking larger vacations because now you realize that all of that really matters now is to take care of this child. Later on, when it comes full circle, I'm hoping that Julia has the same thoughts about us as we need care and need provide. You know, do we allow our lives to be changed by the needs of those around us? I think this morning about Jeff and Jake, who have opened their hearts to being foster parents for children who have been neglected, abandoned by their parents. They become the proud parents of Danny, and we're told a few months ago that they might be the proud parents of another boy, a little boy named Benny. The mother had walked out of the hospital. There's no sign of the dad, and so they love this baby without reservation. And then they find out the dad, the bio dad, is now back in the picture, and beginning on Tuesday will be raising Benny. And you can imagine, just imagine the grief that comes from loving a child deeply, being told there's a good chance you would be the parents, but now having to hand off that child. I was just struck by the courage it takes to love boldly and deeply. How easy it would be for all of us to step back into self-protection. But when you love like Jesus, sometimes it's painful and sometimes it hurts, but you keep doing it because you know this is what it's really all about. It's really what it's meant to be all about in a marriage as well, where two people are joined together to do what? To spur each other on to become more like Christ. And so ideally, in a marriage, people help to mirror what it looks like to be self-sacrificial in love, as opposed to always wanting or needing what the other person is supposed to be giving. It's a matter of outflowing love. How do I honor, listen, respect? We do that, hopefully, at work, a co-worker who's hurting. Or in school, a classmate who's feeling abandoned. There's different ways that we do this. I remember reading the story of Grace Disguise. There was a Presbyterian pastor or professor. I know I shared the story before. He was broadsided by a drunk driver, and his wife, his mother, and his daughter all died in that accident. He had a little boy named John, 2 years old, whose femur was also broken in that accident. And he says, my little son, a broken bone, his mom had died, his father was distraught, and then there was a couple of friends named Ron and Julie who stepped forward and said, we will provide care for your son as long as it takes. She quit her job and for 3 years became someone providing care for John. And the writer, Jerry Sitzer, of that says, what do you say when somebody chooses to step forward at great cost to love? You begin to see something of the heart of God. It can happen in dramatic ways. Sometimes it's just a matter of consistently providing that love, that care, that sacrifice in less obvious ways. But what I do know is that our world today is so in need of people to be friends of Jesus. Not to be defenders of Jesus, not to be warriors for Jesus, not to be stalwarts of maintaining the orthodox of Jesus, but people who will do what he actually asked us to do, which is to love each other in self-sacrificial love. It is this example that provides the only real hope for our world. And may the Spirit of God today move amongst us, granting us courage, hope, determination, and the willingness to say yes to that great call. All praise and honor and glory are due to this God, today, tomorrow, and forevermore. Amen.